For those of you listening to this, unfortunately I messed up during the last segment of the last class. Forgot to turn on the recorder. Actually, you might have already heard the last 10 minutes of the class because I figured it out and turned it on. So I'm going to repeat about a 40-minute segment. So you will not hear people in the background. So just so you know, here I'm just talking to you on the recording. So anyway, we finished in the prayer section talking about claims of inconsistencies and contradictions in the Bible. And our conclusion is that actually, if we look at these claims of inconsistencies, of teaching, of fact, of details in specific events, of doctrine, of theology, in fact, I believe that the case is exactly the opposite of what the critics of the Bible say it is. Which is, if we look at the consistency of the Bible, in fact, it's strong evidence itself for the inspiration of the Bible. Now, I just want to do a few concluding thoughts on biblical inspiration and infallibility before I do one little talk on some evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. So, more thoughts on biblical inspiration. For this, you please follow along on the PowerPoint that's available at the website. Anyway, so more thoughts on biblical inspiration. Hopefully you're on that slide. The Bible has dozens of authors, yet a miraculously consistent message and theme. Think about it. The fact is that if you look at the Bible, you have the writings covering over 1,500 years from probably more than 40 different authors, a dramatically different culture, Babylonian culture, Egyptian culture, a Jewish culture, writings from kings, peasants, priests, prophets, farmers, soldiers, seers, government ministers, musicians, and amazingly, the message, both doctrinally and theologically, is wonderfully, and I would say supernaturally, unified. In fact, I believe all attempts to show contradiction of teaching, of theology, of emphasis, I believe it falls apart in giving the evidence. This alone is strong evidence for the Bible being inspired by God. How else can you explain people of such widely differing background and culture and such different setting, and yet the message is consistent. The message is consistent that the Bible is about God wanting to have a relationship with us and about salvation by faith and those biblical themes that are carried even into the New Testament. And the whole Bible is about Jesus. That's another thing that carries throughout. In John 5:39 and 40, Jesus said to the Jewish leaders, "You've been reading the Bible, and yet you miss the whole point. It's about me." And if we think about the prophecies of the Messiah, and about the prefigures and foreshadows, the entire Old Testament points to Jesus. The 30 pieces of silver. The fact that Moses freed God's people, that out of Egypt I called my son, that's true of God's people, it's true of Moses, it's true of Jesus, it's true of us. Abraham offered his one and only son as God offered his one and only son. Isaac carried the wood up the mountain. Isaac, the only son, carried the wood up the mountain as Jesus, the only son, carried the wood up the mountain that was going to be used for his sacrifice. Moses lifted up a snake in the desert, just like Jesus was lifted up on a wooden pole as well. And those who looked to the snake were saved, and those who looked to Jesus on the cross, they were saved. Why a snake? Because Jesus carried our sins on his body on the tree, 2 Corinthians 5. In so many ways, the whole Bible is about Jesus. That's further evidence for inspiration. Also notice, there's no indication of any other theology like dualism or polytheism or animism or deism or pantheism. All these other isms nowhere in the Bible, despite the fact that the people around them and even some of the Jews held to those ideas. The balance of judgment and grace and all the other teachings being consistent throughout the Bible, further evidence of inspiration, I would say. Let me add to that, and to some extent, I suppose you could debate this is a matter of opinion, but I believe other as is evidence for the inspiration of the Bible is that the Bible is the best in so many categories. I would argue that the Bible is the best psychology book ever written. I would argue it's the best book on teaching and how to be a teacher. And you know, look at Jesus, the most amazing teacher of all time. It's the greatest literature of all time. The Bible is the greatest sort of source of wisdom of all time. Who can beat Ecclesiastes and Proverbs? The Bible has the greatest philosophy. It's greater than postmodernism or modernism or any other philosophy. And the Bible is the greatest book on ethics. And the Bible is the greatest book on character. It's the greatest book on how to raise children. The Bible has the greatest wisdom on finances and how to organize a government. We could go on and on and on. To the point where it's hard to argue against the inspiration of the Bible based on all these teachings. And then another argument for the inspiration of the Bible is how it has changed lives throughout history. We have to be careful about this argument, I have to admit, because I suppose the Hindus will point to change lives, even the Mormons will point to change lives, the Muslims will. In John 7:17, Jesus makes a pretty interesting challenge. He says this to those who were questioning the viability of his teaching and whether his teaching was from man or from God. He said, try it. He says, if you don't believe it, then try to live out the life that I've given you. And I believe it's true that if we simply try to put into practice the principles that Jesus taught, the life that he lived, that would be the greatest life we could ever live. And probably more people have been convinced of the inspiration of the Bible, bottom line, because the message works, perhaps than any other single reason. In fact, this might be the most common reason people accept the inspiration of the Bible, because the Bible is true. It speaks to the human soul. It tells us how to live, and those who live that way live the greatest kind of lives. All this is evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. Now, like I said, in this class, we're not principally defending the inspiration of the Bible through evidence for inspiration. We're defending its reliability. We're defending the text of the New Testament. We're defending that what we have is what was written. We're defending that it does not have contradictions. And what we've not done a lot of here is give direct evidence for it being inspired, in the kind that I would give if I was giving a lecture on the inspiration of the Bible. What I would talk about is the messianic prophecies being fulfilled, the prophecies in Daniel being fulfilled. I would talk about types, prefigures, and foreshadows. I would talk about the scientific accuracy of the Bible. But I'm going to take some time to do one little short segment. We only have about, half an hour, 40 minutes to go. But I want to argue for the inspiration of the Bible from the accuracy, reliability, and believability of the history in the time of the Bible, based on archaeological evidence. So what I'm going to do is just do a really short lesson on the historical reliability of the Bible, which I believe is just one of many categories of evidence for the inspiration of the Bible. So what we're going to do then is let's kind of give an overview, and then we'll go through a number of examples where the Bible shows itself to be the greatest book of history in the ancient world. Now, first of all, unlike any other religion except arguably Judaism, the Bible itself, the teaching of the Bible, and the evidence for the inspiration of the Bible is steeped in history. No other religion is like Christianity or, of course, Judaism in this, that Christianity is the story of God working through history. It's the story of God choosing a people, choosing a person, a man of faith, and creating a people to whom to send prophets and the message, and that the entire thing is the story of preparing the way through prophets and priests and prophecies in order to send the Messiah. And so the Christianity either falls or hangs to some extent on the reliability of its history. Just as an example of how steeped in history it is, consider Joshua, simply just Joshua chapter 1 through 3, which lists 29 different cities, 10 different peoples or nations, and 17 different individual people. Now, either those 29 cities are real, and they really are where the Bible says they are, and either those 10 nations or peoples really existed, and those 17 people actually lived, or not. And if the historical matters in the Bible are not truth, if they're fables, like the critics would say, then really, to some extent, the message of the Bible falls apart as well, because the Bible is largely about God working through history. And of course, the critics have said that the Bible is full of fables and made-up stories, that Jewish scribes and teachers in the 6th, 7th, 8th century made up a bunch of really cool stories in order to give the impression that the God of the Jews is the God of the overall God of the entire universe. These are stories, not really even believable. And yet, I believe, as we're going to see in the next few minutes, that that's simply not true. That the Bible shows every evidence of being by far, without any rival, the most accurate book of history in the ancient world. Think about this. Think about other ancient historians. Think about the histories that are recorded by the Egyptians or the Assyrians or the Babylonians. And in every case, they're kind of, they're an extremely biased account. To the extent they're accurate, they only record the victories. If you read the histories of recorded by the Syrian kings, they won every battle, they defeated everyone. You don't see any defeats. And yet, if you read the history recorded in the Old Testament, there are many defeats. It's kind of embarrassing, actually. The most famous historian of the ancient world was Herodotus. Herodotus and Thucydides were two Greek historians. And to be honest with you, they were actually pretty amazing historians. Generally, what they said was reliable. Unlike other historians, they did report of defeats and et cetera. But interestingly, Herodotus's nickname was the father of lies. Why? Because his history is so biased. He was clearly a defender of Athens, and he put Athens in a very positive light. He put Sparta and the Persians in a negative light. And also, he has many accounts of peoples far off, clear fables, myths, things that you get the feeling even he didn't believe. And in many ways, his histories contain things that really I think even his contemporaries didn't believe, never mind us. And yet the Bible has nothing like that. In fact, the Bible really reflects the foibles, the mistakes that are real in history. Now, a little bit as we go into this, let's think about this. When in the entire timeline of the Old Testament should we begin to see actual cities and buildings and settlements that should reflect the history found in the Old Testament? From the time of the patriarchs of Abraham and Isaac and Jacob, from the time that Israel was enslaved in Egypt, till the departure from Egypt, the wandering in the wilderness, entering the promised land, establishing a foothold there, through the time of David and the United Kingdom, and later the divided kingdom, and the ascending into exile. When should we begin to see physical evidence in support of what we find in the Old Testament? By the way, just so you know, when I asked that question in the class, people guessed maybe during the time of Moses. But the fact is, during the time of Moses, God's people were living in extreme poverty. They were impoverished. They were slaves. And there's no reason to expect we'll find monuments or buildings built that are obviously Jewish buildings. I would conclude that only after the time of David should you begin to see cities and walls and even inscriptions and things that should reflect the things found in the Old Testament. Before that time, what should we find, for example, is Genesis should reflect the culture of Mesopotamia, the culture of ancient Babylon and ancient Samaria, in roughly 2000 BC. On the other hand, the books of Exodus, Leviticus, Numbers, Deuteronomy should reflect the culture of Egypt in the 15th and 14th centuries BC. And then from then on, the time of the Judges and the divided United Kingdom should reflect early Iron Age, late Bronze Age, Palestine. In fact, that's exactly what you find. So let me go through a few examples. For example, what about Abraham? The story of Abraham involves him being born in the city of Ur. And you get this sense in Genesis that Ur was a very prosperous city. And from there he goes to the city of Haran. And Haran you don't get the impression that Haran is a large city. It's a bit more on the outskirts of civilization. Exactly is the case. The city of Ur has been located. It's in a southern Mesopotamia. And it was perhaps the largest and most prosperous city of the ancient Babylonian Empire, which agrees in general with the picture you get in the book of Genesis. On the other hand, Haran's also been discovered. You can see in the PowerPoint the remains of Haran. Haran was a smaller city. It's in northwest Mesopotamia, kind of on the outskirts of Mesopotamia. The city of Haran was destroyed roughly 1800 BC, and as far as we can tell, was never occupied again after that time. Which is interesting, because if you believe what the critics say, which is the Bible is just a bunch of fantasies and fables and interesting stories with very little historical value, written around 800 or 700 or 600 BC, well, that's interesting because the city of Haran had not existed for over 1,000 years. And the probability they would have even been aware of the city of Haran to use it as supposed name in their fable, it seems very unlikely. And yet, sure enough, Genesis is accurate in that way. Now, and then there's the Ebla tablets. You can see that in the PowerPoint. Ebla was a city in northeast Syria, kind of on the area between the Levant and Mesopotamia. And they found 17,000 tablets, an amazing trove. These are small tablets, most of them from around 2100 BC. It's in it's got the language of that time. It's got these little wedge marks that were formed there. And in these tablets, you have things like agricultural records, tax records, their record keeping details that aren't that interesting to us, although historians think they're great. What was found in these tablets was somebody named Nahor, somebody named Terug, somebody named Abram, a woman named Sarai. And this shows that what we read in the book of Genesis contains names that were common in Mesopotamia in the period of around 2100 BC. To illustrate the importance of this, let's imagine somebody gave you a letter. They handed you a letter and they said this letter was written in 1870. You're reading it and it mentions somebody named Brittany. And it mentions somebody named Skyler or Jamal. And you know right away this is a forgery. Because there was nobody named Brittany in 1870. And if, as the critics of the Bible would say, it's inaccurate history, in fact, it's not history at all, it's just a fable, then how could it contain the names that probably had been not used by anybody for over 1,000 years? Nobody ever even heard the name Nahor or Terug or Abram or Sarai for 1,000 years. And again, although this is indirect evidence that the Bible does reflect an accurate picture of Mesopotamia in the year 2000 BC, nevertheless, it is evidence for that. I would say strong evidence. Another interesting story is in Genesis chapter 31. Here, Jacob has been living with Laban for something like 21 years. And during that time, he developed a massive amount of wealth. And he left with Rachel and Leah and vast herds of cattle and sheep and goats and camels. And in what's interesting in Genesis 31, Laban travels a great distance to track him down, not to get his daughters back, not to get the sheep or the camels or the goats back, but to get the household gods back, because Rachel had hidden them in the baggage. It's very odd. What the heck is going on here? But then, in a list of Babylonian laws, I believe from the beginning of the second millennium BC, they found this law which said anyone who possessed the household gods inherited all the family property. Aha! And this is one of a number of examples where you can see a cultural thing that doesn't really make sense if we're talking Palestine 700, 800, 600 BC, but fits perfectly the context of the culture, history, and background of Mesopotamia, roughly 2000 BC. So again, I can't prove that Abraham lived in Ur, that he traveled through Haran, that he lived in tents, but what I can say is the book of Genesis, unlike logically would be true if the critics are right, the book of Genesis reflects the culture and history of Mesopotamia in the time when Abraham and Isaac supposedly lived. Okay, next, what about Sodom and Gomorrah? If you read in Genesis chapter 14, starting in verse 2, you can read about a league of five cities, specifically Sodom, Gomorrah, Admah, Zeboiim, and Zoar, how Abraham and Lot formed a league with those kings to fight a battle against the Elamite king Chedorlaomer. Kind of interesting, because Elam is pretty far away. It's kind of interesting battle. And of course, the critics said, whatever, Sodom and Gomorrah, these aren't real cities. This is just a fable. It doesn't make sense. In fact, if you read in Genesis 12:13, you see that Abraham said to Lot, hey, Lot, go take the good farmland, the awesome farmland down there by the Dead Sea. And Abraham took the not-so-great farmland up in the hills of Judea. Well, today, the hills of Judea are a lot better than anything in the Dead Sea. In fact, if you go to the area around the Dead Sea, it is one of the most desolate places in the entire earth. No evidence of people living there or occupying that area for thousands of years. But back in the 70s, a couple of archaeologists thought, why not? Let's actually go down there and see if there's evidence of occupation. And here's what they found, an astounding thing. What they found is that around 2200, 2100 BC, there was actually a thriving agriculture. Now, it's not like this was some kind of tropical paradise. Even then, the air was fairly dry. But what there were a number of wadis. And a wadi is a intermittent river, which may or may not have water running all year, but during the wetter season runs with quite a bit of water. That water could be stored. Some of them maybe had water passing all year, unlike today where there are canyons that are dry probably 360 days out of the year. Anyway, what they found at the openings of these wadis was cities. And they found evidence of extensive agriculture based on, on canals. So this was farming based on sending water out to there. I'm forgetting the name for agriculture using stored water. Anyway, and what they found was evidence for, guess how many cities? You got it. Five cities. All five of those cities were destroyed somewhere between 2200 and 2000 BC, all destroyed seemingly at the same time, all destroyed by fire and never occupied again. Not only were the cities never occupied again, but the area was never farmed again. We don't have evidence of farming or of irrigation. That's the word I was looking for. In fact, the area was basically abandoned. All five cities destroyed by fire. The largest of the cities, as you can see in the PowerPoint, is is Bab et Dra. It's the northernmost of the cities. And by the way, back then, the Dead Sea was significantly larger than it is now because it was wetter back then. Anyway, they found as much as 7 feet thick ashes. If you go down a couple slides, you can see an actual excavation from the city that almost certainly is Sodom. Very interesting. About half a mile outside of Sodom, there was a fairly large graveyard cemetery. And in that cemetery, there are these former wooden structures. And the evidence is they burned from the top to the bottom. Interesting. Here we have indirect evidence, I'll admit, and arguably perhaps not even really strong evidence, but evidence nevertheless of a miracle that was recorded in the Bible leading to the destruction of these five cities and the burning of this cemetery from top to bottom. So much for this being a fable built up out of nothing. Next, as you go into Deuteronomy and Joshua, you see all these cities, the Hittites, the Hivites, the Girgashites, the Jebusites, all these ites. And until the end of the 19th century, the critics of the Old Testament, the critics of Jewish history, laughed at these. There's Hittites, Hivites. Who are these people? This is obviously just a story. Now, the one mentioned the most of those would be the Hittites. In fact, the Hittites are mentioned 47 times in the Old Testament. In fact, if you read the accounts in the Old Testament, it seems like Hittites were the most powerful of these groups. In fact, they even fought battles against the Egyptians. Anyway, this skepticism towards the reliability of the Bible as history ended in 1906 when the archaeologist Hugo Winkler discovered the city of Hattusha. You can see in the slide the remains of Hattusha was a rather large city. In fact, it was the capital of an extended empire, the Hittite Empire. And dozens of cities that go back to Hittite times, that were Hittite cities, have been discovered since this time. And in fact, the evidence is that the Hittites were the major power in opposition to the Egyptians in the 14th, 13th, 12th, and 11th centuries B.C. After that, it was Assyria. After that, Hittite power became less. But that exactly matches the biblical picture here. If you go to the next slide, you can see the city gate in Hattusha, the city that, according to the critics of the Bible back in the 19th century, the people that didn't even exist. In fact, you can actually major in Hittite history and language at a couple of different universities. Again, so much for the critics. Now, here's how it works. Those who say the Bible has a bunch of stories and fables, can't believe anything in it, it's just a bunch of made-up stuff, what they do is their story keeps shifting. You say, there were no Hittites. And then we find the ruins of the Hittites. Well, okay. And Daniel never lived. And you show evidence that Daniel lived. There's no such thing as Jehoiachin or David was not a real person. And then what you do is you show evidence that these things were in fact true, and they don't say, you know what, well, fine, I guess I was wrong. Maybe the Bible is fairly reliable. No, they just continue the same story. It's a bunch of fables and myths, and yet their territory keeps getting smaller and smaller and smaller. When are they going to accept the obvious, which is that the Bible is the most reliable, the most detailed, the most realistic book of history from the entire ancient world? Okay, next we have the papyrus Ipawer. It's a document from the 13th century BC. Now, it's a manuscript, an interesting manuscript, that represents a story from before. We don't know exactly when, but we find some interesting history here recorded that's curiously similar to the events of the Exodus. Part of it talks about a river being blood, which is parallel to Exodus 7:20. And another thing, it says blood is everywhere. Blood is throughout the land, which agrees with Exodus 7:21. It talks about the trees being destroyed and hail breaking every tree in the field, which matches Exodus 9:25, and it says the land is not light, and whereas in Exodus 10:22 it says Moses stretched forward his hand and there was thick darkness. And then it says the places, he who places his brother in the ground is everywhere, for there was not a house where there was not someone dead, which parallels Exodus 12:30. Again, whether this is a smoking gun for the Exodus, I think that would be a bit overstating the case, but clearly we see something in concert with the Old Testament. Next, the Tel El Amarna letters. Now, El Amarna is a city built largely, at least begun to be built, by the Jews. We know that from history. And it was occupied during the time of King Akhenaten. And what they found was a number of clay tablets. And there was a trove of tablets, a collection of letters written from kings and princes and rulers from Palestine around 1400 BC. Now, most of those tablets are not of that much interest to us, but one of them is very interesting. And it's from a local king, and he says this. He says, "The Hebrew plunder all the lands of the king. If archers are here this year, then the lands of the king, the Lord, will remain. But if archers are not here, then the lands of the king, my Lord, are lost." I don't know. Smoking gun proof? I don't know. But who do you think these Hebrew just might be? I say they might be the Hebrews. By the way, the letter could be Hebrew or Hapiru, and people debate this. I'm not going to say this is a smoking gun proof that, in fact, the Jews did come from outside of Palestine and did invade Palestine and did indeed conquer parts of Palestine roughly 1400 BC, but I'd say it's suggestive. And then there's the evidence regarding Jericho. Here's an item. The Deir Al inscription found in Ammon near the Jabbok River from the 8th century BC that mentions Balaam, a biblical character, Balaam the seer. All right, next, Jericho. Now here, the critics of the reliability of the Old Testament have pointed out that there's no evidence of a massive invasion and destruction that occurred around 1400 BC when the most likely time for the Exodus and the conquest occurred. And that's true, but actually if you read the book of Joshua, what you see is that in most cases, God instructed them not to destroy the city. They defeated the people in battle and drove them out of the cities, and they occupied the cities without destroying them. In fact, in Judges, only three cities were destroyed, and that is Jericho, Ai, and Hazor. And it turns out, interestingly, where does the archaeological evidence point? Well, it points to only two major cities being destroyed at that time, which were Jericho and Hazor. I've got here a quote from one of the most well-known archaeologists of the Jews, Ben Tor, and he said, "There is evidence of massive destruction," referring to Hazor, around 1400 BC. "I once called it the mother of all destruction. Hazor, wherever you come to the end of the Canaanite layers, you come upon this destruction. It's an unbelievable destruction. It left behind a thick debris of ashes. There's a terrible fire in the palace, so much so that the bricks vitrified and some of the clay vessels melted." All right, so there you go. And so both Jericho and Hazor have evidence of being destroyed in roughly the right time. What about Ai? Well, the identity of what was called Ai in the book of Joshua has not been clearly established. It might be Bethel, but we're not sure. But the bottom line is the evidence is in agreement. Another great city at the time, Megiddo, was not destroyed. In fact, Megiddo remained a Canaanite city for three or four centuries, which, by the way, happens to agree with the biblical account, because Megiddo was not conquered by the Jews until the time of Solomon. So again, all the evidence is in agreement. What about Jericho? Well, there's evidence of a destruction in the 15th century BC, the late 15th century. The evidence is the city was strongly fortified. that it was taken after a fairly short siege because there were was grain in the granaries. There's no evidence of a long siege. There's no evidence of massive plundering, which of course is in agreement with what we see in Joshua. So again, it's consistent with the biblical accounts. Next is the Stela of Merneptah. This comes from 1230 BC. It's the first clear evidence of the Israel, and it mentions Israel in the 13th century BC. So you know what? Now we have proof that Israel was a real nation, and it did exist in Palestine in the 13th century BC, which moves the date that the critics would allow roughly 400 years earlier than they would have been willing to admit. Again, consistent with the Bible. Next, we have the Moabite stone. And this from the 9th century BC. It's found in the city of Misha, which is in Moab. It's now in the Louvre. And it mentions Abraham calling him Ahab of the house of Omri. And sure enough, you can read about Ahab. I'm sure you've heard of Ahab. And in the Old Testament, Ahab is the son of Omri. And so what this shows, I'd say, clear, unmistakable evidence that there was a dynasty founded by Omri, of whom Ahab is a member of that dynasty. In fact, the last member of that dynasty, in agreement with 1 Kings chapter 16. Okay, next is the Tel Dan inscription. This is an awesome one. It mentions details in parallel with 2 Kings 8, verse 28 and 29, which talks about what happened when the Samaritans, the people from Damascus, were fighting and occupying the northern kingdom. Anyway, it's a letter from Hazael. It's found in the city of Dan, which is in the northeast corner, essentially, of the territory occupied by the Jews. At this time, it was occupied by the Aramaeans. But anyway, this stone is found kind of in a wall. It was the city had been broken down. They rebuilt a wall from the rubble. And in this, it's Hazael is saying this. He says, "I killed Jehoram, son of Ahab, king of Israel, and I killed Ahaziah, son of Jehoram, king of the house of David." So what we have here is clear evidence that there was a dynasty founded by David, and this would be roughly 1050 BC. It's now 820 BC. More than 200 years later, we have a dynasty founded by Abraham, one of whose inheritors was Ahaziah, another was Jehoram. So I believe Jehoram was real. I believe Ahaziah was real. I believe that King David was a real king, and he was the founder of a great dynasty in Judea. I also believe that Ahab was real. Of course, we had the Moabite stone for that. Here's an interesting thing. He says that he killed Ahab and he killed Ahaziah. Well, if you read in 2 Kings 8, 28 and 29, it agrees that he killed Ahab, but he says, no, he only wounded Jehoram. In fact, Jehoram fled the battlefield, and Jehu killed Jehoram. That's in 2 Kings chapter 8. Now, here's the question. Which is more believable? That Hazael killed Jehoram, or that he was wounded and he was killed by Jehu? And common sense says probably that Hazael thought he killed Jehoram, but in fact he didn't kill him, he only wounded him. Of course, he died soon after, so it wasn't reasonable for him to think that. It wasn't unreasonable. But I believe that the biblical account is more reliable, and that this is the pattern. Whenever we have external sources, external inscriptions, external evidence, and we have biblical evidence, the biblical account is always as or more reliable than the external account. All right, then we have the Black Obelisk of Shalmaneser, which is found in the British Museum. It's awesome. One of the things to note is you don't find statues of kings. You don't find monuments. You don't find large inscriptions in Judea and Samaria. But the reason for that is that there were laws against this. They weren't allowed to make graven images. So if we want to see inscriptions, if we want to see carvings relating to Jewish kings, Israelite kings, Judah kings, you have to go outside of Judea and Samaria. But anyway, as you can see, here's an up-close picture of a king bowing to Sennacherib. The king is actually Jehu. The inscription below the base relief says that this is King Jehu of Israel bowing down to Shalmaneser. The year is 840 BC. In 2 Kings 17:3 through 6, it does say that Jehu gave tribute to Shalmaneser. It doesn't say that he went and actually bowed down before the king. And maybe he did, maybe he didn't. Maybe this is more symbolic, or maybe he bowed down towards him actually in Palestine. But either way, I think it's sort of cool. We have an actual base relief carving showing a King Jehu bowing down to Shalmaneser, which confirms the events of 2 Kings 18:1 through 19:37, Isaiah 36:18 through 21, and 37:16 through 20. Pretty cool stuff. And then there's the Sennacherib cylinder. This also is in a British Museum. It's actually only about a foot and a half tall. The writing is tiny on this thing. It's pretty awesome. Anyway, here Sennacherib is bragging about his many victories. And it has stuff. I'm sorry, I misread my earlier notes. The Sennacherib cylinder has things in common with 2 Kings 18:1 through 19:37, Isaiah 36:1, 18 through 21, and 37:16 through 20. Anyway, here we have him bragging about the fact that he defeated Judah. And he says this: "As to Hezekiah the Jew, he did not submit to my yoke. I laid siege to 46 of his strong cities, walled forts, and to countless villages in their vicinity. I drove out of them 200,150 people, young and old, male and female, horses, mules, donkeys, camels, big and small cattle, beyond counting, and considered them booty. Himself I made a prisoner in Jerusalem, his royal residence, like a bird in a cage." And of course, all these details agree in every detail with exactly what happened, because according to the biblical account, Sennacherib conquered all of Judea except Jerusalem itself, and he put Jerusalem under siege. But what's interesting, it says here, I made Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. End of story. Because like all the ancient accounts, it only records the victories, not the defeats. In fact, I believe we have clear evidence that he did not conquer Jerusalem. In fact, he only put it under siege, and then he left. In fact, the biblical account says that very night, 2 Kings 18, his entire army was destroyed by the destroying angel. Now, I'm not going to say this is smoking evidence of a biblical miracle, but I believe it is good evidence of a biblical miracle, because here is the greatest general of his time with the greatest army of his time surrounding the city and then just giving it up. Why? Well, I would argue because of a miracle, because God destroyed his troops. Next is the Siloam inscription. Here you have, I would say, smoking gun evidence of an event that's recorded in 2 Kings 20, 20 through 21, where it says, "Now the rest of the acts of Hezekiah, all his might, and how he made a pool and a tunnel and brought water into the city, are they not written in the book of the Chronicles of the King of Judah? So Hezekiah rested with his fathers." And yes, it is a fact. It is a fact that Hezekiah did build this tunnel. The reason we know that is because we found an inscription in the middle of the tunnel, right at the place where the two ends met. So what they did, apparently, is they began a tunnel from the water source and a tunnel from underneath the city, and they met somewhere in between. And then to celebrate that, they put this plaque up there, and the inscription is there to this very day. You can actually go down there and see it. And it records the story of meeting. It says, and this was the story of the boring through while the workmen were hacking their way from opposite ends. And while there were still 3 cubits to be bored through, they heard voices calling from each side, for there was a crevice in the rock. And on the day when the boring was completed, the stone builders hacked their way toward each other until they met. The water flowed from the spring to the pool, 1,200 cubits. And the height of the rock above the heads of the stonecutters was 100 cubits. Awesome. Again, smoking gun evidence that Hezekiah was in fact a general who did in fact have a city under siege, who did in fact build a long tunnel to bring water into the city. All right, and then there's the Lachish Room. This is in the British Museum, an entire room, and you can go through these slides. You can see the armies of the Assyrians carrying Jewish slaves and captives. You can see the soldiers and the slaves. You can see the Jewish people being flayed alive in front of the city as a means to get the Jews to submit, and yet they didn't. We know that because Lachish was destroyed, as Sennacherib says, and as the book of Jeremiah tells us. Actually, that's a later account. But anyway, Lachish was destroyed. That's by the Assyrians. Now here's the Babylonian destruction of Lachish. So you have in front of you, hopefully, one of the Lachish letters from 588 BC. This is recorded in Jeremiah chapter 34, verses 6 and 7. Let's read that together. That's pretty cool. Actually, it's pretty sad. It's a record of one of the saddest moments in the entire history of Judaism. Jeremiah 34, verses 6 and 7. Let's turn there. Now, this is after Daniel, Shadrach, Meshach had been taken into captivity, after Jehoiachin has been taken into a captivity and the wall partially torn down. This is the time of Zedekiah, the uncle of Jehoiachin. Jeremiah 34, verse 6 and 7. It says here, so Jeremiah the prophet related all these words to Zedekiah, king of Judah, in Jerusalem. While the king of Babylon's army was attacking Jerusalem and all of Judah's remaining citizens against Lachish and Azekah, for only they were left among Judah's fortified cities. So here we have all the cities of Judah having been conquered. This is not Sennacherib now. This is by Nebuchadnezzar. And one of the clay shards found right at the city gate in the ruins of Lachish from the destruction of Lachish by the Babylonians said this. It says, the light at the top of Azekah just went out and we are next. And basically, the person who wrote this was trying to send a letter to Jerusalem asking them to send reinforcements to save Lachish. Obviously, the letter never got sent because it was found in the destruction of Lachish. And it says the light in Azekah just went out. In other words, what he's saying here is Azekah just got conquered. We're next. And that is exactly what happened. We know that because we can read that in Jeremiah. So here we see striking proof that, as Jeremiah records, that the last two holdout cities were Azekah and Lachish, that Azekah fell first and then Lachish, and then, of course, as we know, sadly, then later Jerusalem as well. Okay, next, the Babylonian Chronicles. Now here is Nebuchadnezzar bragging about his conquest of the Jews. It's a record of the first battle, actually. It came before the Lachish letters. It's 597 BC. It says, in the seventh year of his reign, the month of Kislev, the king of Babylonia mustered his forces, marched to Syria. He camped against the city of Judah, that is Jerusalem. And on the second day of the month of Adar, he took the city and captured the king. He appointed a king of his own choice there, that would be Zedekiah, took heavy tribute and brought them to Babylon. I'm in agreement with 2 Kings chapter 24. Sort of cool. All right, next is a story. Actually, the story is found in in 2 Kings, the story is of Jehoiachin being taken in captivity. 2 Kings 25, 27 through 30, which says, day by day, the king gave Jehoiachin a regular allowance as long as he lived. So according to 2 Kings 25, this is an interesting detail. It's a fairly small detail. But what it says is, after Jehoiachin was taken as a captive, even though he's blinded, he was taken to Babylon, where he was treated well by the king and given food till the day he died, for many, many years, actually. Well, what was found in the ruins of Babylon was this, a list of rations being given to various peoples. And interestingly, guess whose name is mentioned there? Jehoiachin, which would be Jehoiachin. And what's interesting is he's given 10 times the rations of the other royal residents that were being held there in good agreement. So yes, Jehoiachin was taken to Babylon. And yes, he was given great treatment there by the king. All right, I'm going to just summarize the rest, because at this point you get the idea, right? My last example, so I'm going to skip the Cyrus Cylinder, even though that's pretty awesome. The Cyrus Cylinder, which shows Cyrus bragging about the way he treated the people. He let them go and rebuild their temples, which of course is what indeed happened with the Jews, which is in agreement with what you find in the book of Ezra. Instead, here we see the Ziggurat and Ur. Now, this relates to something in Daniel chapter 5. Now, you have to realize that those who want to discount the Old Testament as fables and made-up story will tell you there is nobody named Daniel. There was nobody named Belshazzar that was killed on that night. This is a fantasy made up. And really, they'd say the book of Daniel was written after 160 BC because the things it purports to prophesy are actually things that had already happened. Well, if you go to Daniel chapter 5, it says that Belshazzar offered to Daniel the third highest place in the kingdom. Interestingly, Herodotus doesn't even mention Belshazzar. In fact, none of the ancient records mention Belshazzar. They all agree that Nabonidus was the last of the Babylonian kings. Well, then in the late 20th century, I believe in the 1970s, in the Ziggurat in Ur, they found an inscription that tells us what actually happened. Nabonidus was the last official king, it's true, but Nabonidus had a palace coup in which he overthrew evil Merodach, had him killed. He took the throne illegitimately. He was not the son of Nebuchadnezzar, the great king of Babylon. But what he did was he married the daughter of Nebuchadnezzar. And he had a son, and guess what his name was? Belshazzar. And Belshazzar was the legitimate heir to Nebuchadnezzar. So what Nabonidus did was he made Belshazzar a regent king as a means to kind of prop up the legitimacy of his rule. And the evidence is, even according to the inscription, that Nabonidus really wasn't even an effective ruler. He went off. He was out in the desert doing different things. And Belshazzar ruled as effective king in his place for 17 years. Now that explains Daniel chapter 5. Why is it that Belshazzar offered him the third place in the kingdom? The reason is that Belshazzar occupied the second place in the kingdom. And this was a fact that apparently, based on the other historians, that was not even known to people in the 2nd century BC when supposedly Daniel was written. So what Herodotus and others should have done is they should have read the book of Daniel, and they would have found out that the last effective king and ruler of Babylon was Belshazzar. All right. Now, I don't have time to go over all the evidence that supports the historical reliability of the New Testament. But if you want to zip through the slides with me, we can see, you know what, despite what the critics say, I say that Pontius Pilate was in fact procurator of Judea, as found in the Pilate inscription. And I believe they did crucify by putting the nails to the ankles. And I believe the Pool of Siloam really was an actual pool. And I believe that Caiaphas really was the high priest because we have his ossuary, and it says Caiaphas, the son of Joseph, as we can see in the book of Acts. And I believe that they did say, whatever I give to you would be Korban, because of this inscription that uses the word Korban on an offering that was being given in Jerusalem. And I believe that Sergius Paulus really was a real person, and that the leader in Thessalonica was in fact called a politarch, and that that Gallo was an actual ruler in Greece because of the inscription found in Delphi, and that Erastus was an actual person, important person in Corinth, as recorded in Acts 19, etc., etc., etc. All right, so anyway, that ends our class. But hopefully through this class, you've come to realize that when we say the Bible is reliable, that it is an accurate reflection of the autographs, and that those autographs are indeed inspired, and the Bible is reliable what we have, and the Bible is inspired by God. Hopefully you realize that this is a believable thing. Anyway, thanks for being part of our class. Hope to see you in February when we'll have another class. Thank you very much.